Hello, you are listening to One in Two, a Manchester Cancer Research podcast brought to you by the University of Manchester and the Manchester Cancer Research Centre. With one in two of us receiving a cancer diagnosis at some point in our lifetime, it has never been more important for our research to improve the outcomes for people affected by cancer. I am your host, Sally Best, and throughout this series, I'll be speaking with Manchester cancer researchers about their innovations, discoveries, and projects that are changing the landscape of cancer detection and treatment. In this special episode, we speak to David Wedge, Professor of Cancer Genomics and Data Science, about breast cancer in Black African women. We discuss cancer genomics and what we understand ethnicity to be in the context of genomic research. David Wedge! Da-da-da-da-da. Oh, this is so exciting. We've got David Wedge in today. Yeah?
Thank you. I'm pleased to be here.
How are you doing? It's D-Day.
Very, very good. Thank you.
David Day, Mr. Worldwide. And we're in the new studio, David.
Yeah.
Do you feel beautiful. Very special?
Yeah.
You're the first person to have ever stepped foot in here and recorded in here with me.
Really?
I feel like a kid with a new toy at Christmas. And Christmas has already been. And we've got a new kind of view, camera view, and people can see more of us now. So you guys get to see that my new jumper's on. I don't know if it's a bit too Christmassy, but I quite like it.
Yeah.
I think it's, we get away with it. So anyway, thank you for joining us. You're doing okay?
Yes, I'm good. Thank you.
Coping. Was your Christmas okay?
Yes, thanks. Yeah.
For our good listeners, we're in January 2024. If you're listening, 10 years in the future. And David will still be storming ahead. But anyway, it's so great to have you here. And I mean, could you just kind of start by telling me a little bit about you, what you do, in terms of like the work, kind of your work background and, you know?
Yeah. So I work in cancer genomics, and I can say a little bit about that. So when we talk about genomics, we're talking about DNA. So you have DNA in all of your cells, and we study that DNA.
Yeah.
The difference between genomics and genetics, which a lot of the listeners will have heard of, is genetics is usually focused on kind of individual genes and looking at the function of individual genes. Whereas when we're looking at genomics, we're looking at all of the genes. So we have, all of us have 20,000 genes within all of our cells, and we look at them all together. So we usually do whole genome sequencing. So we look at all of the genes in the cells and look at how they interact and work together to cause cancer. So I've been working in cancer genomics for 12 years. I just find it really, really fascinating how cancer finds this way of kind of growing really, you know, faster than other cells, of, you know, not dying. And the way they do that is largely through altering their genes, because that alters the whole function of the cells.
And what was your path into genomics?
So it's actually not been at all linear.
That's great. We don't like linear paths. I mean, no simplicity allowed
how long,
here.
How long have you got?
give us a synopsis, David, is all I'll ask for.
So my undergraduate degree, my first degree, was actually in chemistry.
First degree,
which I did at Oxford. I never actually worked in chemistry, though, after I completed my degree. I actually went into teaching. So I was teaching primary school kids for 7 years. I got a bit fed up with teaching because... I think I was a good teacher and I enjoyed teaching, but I kind of got a bit fed up with being told what to do by the government. You know, they introduced all these kind of testing of the children and so on, which I really didn't enjoy at all. So I went back to university. I did a master's in software development. I then went on to do a PhD in kind of artificial intelligence. It was kind of maths and computing. And that actually wasn't in genomics at all. It was actually, I was trying to predict how much water would come over seawalls And I was using these kind of machine learning, artificial neural networks methods for trying to predict how much water would come over seawalls. After that, I did a series of research posts, postdoctoral research posts, and I was working actually in Manchester, looking at metabolomics, which is the kind of small molecules. Then I moved on to proteomics, that's looking at the proteins, and then I moved on to genomics, and that's looking at the DNA. So I did various different projects looking at different aspects of biology. And then from there, I then kind of got stuck because I thought, actually, this is what I want to do.
Yeah.
I think genomics is fascinating. And so I've kind of got stuck in that area, and I've been working in cancer genomics for ever since.
God, you've been all over the shop. I love it. That can tell everybody that careers are not for life.
Absolutely. I think, you know, if you see something else that you're interested in, then go for it. You know, it's there's no point staying stuck in a job if you're not enjoying it, and you can see something else that you would rather do. Then go for it.
Good message for the day. And you've said before that you don't actually. So is it past? I know back then it was O levels. You don't have any qualification past O levels of biology.
No, that's right. So I gave up biology.
Shame on you, David. Shame on you.
So I did chemistry and physics A levels and maths and English actually.
Oh, I didn't.
The reason that I went for chemistry rather than biology was because what I really like about chemistry is the underlying molecular model. So you do all these experiments and you get all of that, you generate all of this data, but there's also this underlying explanatory model, which is all based on atoms and molecules.
Mm.
And so you're using that model to explain all of the observable phenomena. And at the time that I was doing O-level biology, which is some time ago, we didn't really have that model in biology.
Yeah.
But I think since with the advent of genomics, I think that is the underlying model, and genomics can explain not everything, but it can explain really a large amount of the observable biology. So I think biology is now at the stage that chemistry was kind of 40 years ago, where they do now have this explanatory model. And for me, because I'm essentially I'm a computational scientist, so what I do is I analyze the data. And so for me, having that underlying explanatory model means that I can use my skills, because I can analyze all of this genomic data, and I think I'm putting my skills to good use in biology, working with this genomic model.
Yeah. So if you had your time now, would you do biology?
Maybe, yes. Yeah, maybe I'd actually go into biology now. Yeah.
Trying to convert you. It's best subject ever. Sorry, I sound a bit biased. And so from your kind of line of work, what's been your overall view of what have you learned about how different cancers evolve?
Yeah, So when we talk about evolution in cancer, our focus is quite different to how you might normally think about evolution. So when we talk about evolution, you think of Darwinian evolution. It's about how species, you'll have a lot of individuals who are members of a species, and they will acquire mutations which allow them to change their behavior. Those will be selected over time, and eventually you get emergence of a new species, because you've got enough mutations that they actually become differentiated from the previous ancestor.
Mm-hmm.
And when we're looking at cancer, we're not looking at evolution of individuals, we're actually looking at the evolution of cells, individual cells.
Yep.
So when we look at a cancer, what we see is that actually a cancer isn't just a homogeneous mass. Actually, if you look at the individual cells, every cell within a cancer is different. So each cell will have acquired a number of mutations that are only seen in that cell. Some of those cells might acquire an advantage. They might get a mutation in a gene, which means that they can grow a bit faster than the cells around it. And then, so that will give rise to lots of daughter cells and granddaughter cells, and it might outgrow the other cells within the tumour. So that's why we have evolution. It's because we have mutations that are occurring in the cells, generating lots of heterogeneity, lots of different cells, and then they're competing with each other.
Yep.
And that's leading to evolution. I guess we kind of look at the evolution in three phases. So the first thing we look at is why do normal, healthy cells become cancer? And I mean, the simple answer is mutations. So mm-hmm. there are mutations occurring all the time in normal and in cancer cells. If you're unlucky, then one of those mutations might affect a gene that causes cancer. So there are some like very well-known genes BRCA1, BRCA2, which cause breast cancer.
Yeah.
So you might be unlucky because one of your normal cells might acquire a mutation which causes that cell to become cancerous. And then because it's divided, that cell will divide, give rise to two daughter cells. They'll keep dividing. Then you may get a growing cancer. One of the interesting things that we found when looking at that you know, how normal cells become cancer is that so you have lots of these small mutations. They'd just be single base pair mutations. You mm-hmm. see them in normal and in cancer cells. But what really seems to distinguish cancer from normal cells is actually these large-scale rearrangements. So as well as having single base pair mutations, you can get these massive rearrangements in cancer. And in fact, we nearly always see large-scale structural rearrangements in cancer, but we rarely see them in normal cells. So it looks like in terms of the evolutionary process, that is the key event that really enables normal cells to become cancer. The other phases of evolution that we look at are kind of how tumours become more aggressive and how they're able to grow larger. And that is different when we look at different tumour types. So if you look at the genes that are mutated in breast cancer, mm-hmm. then they'll be quite different to the genes that we see mutated in, you know, leukemia or liver cancer or whatever. You know, every cancer actually has different drivers. But what they all have in common is that they are all evolve over time, and they all have lots of heterogeneity. So when we look at the cancer cells, they're always we always see lots of differences between the different cells. And I suppose the third and final phase of evolution that we look at is the transition from the primary organ to metastatic site. So
okay.
your cancers as they grow, sometimes you'll have some cells that that acquire the ability to break off from the primary tumour, go into the bloodstream or the lymph system, and they can spread to other sites. And again, that's an evolutionary process.
Mm-hmm.
And we can look at that genomically. We can identify what are the mutations that are enabling cells to become metastatic. But I think in that situation, we're also very interested in the normal cells that are around the tumour. Because if you think about metastasis, you've got a cell that is in the primary organ. What happens when it metastasizes is that it has to go into a completely different environment, because it has to break away from the primary site, go into the blood, survive in the blood, lodge itself in some distant site, and then grow in that distant site. And because that's going to be a different tissue, a different organ, it's going to be a very different environment.
Yeah.
So when we're thinking about metastasis, as well as looking at the tumour genomics, we need to actually think about the microenvironment, so this is the surrounding normal cells and what they're doing. So effectively, we've got a kind of co-evolution process. We're looking at how the normal cells around the tumour respond to the cancer cells, and how the cancer cell responds to the surrounding normal cells.
Yeah.
So in a lot of our studies, we're now looking not just at the evolution of the cancer, but we're also very interested in how the surrounding normal tissue responds to that cancer cell. And there are things like the immune cell response. So your body is supposed to detect the cancer cells and eliminate them, but sometimes it doesn't work so effectively.
Yeah.
So we are increasingly in recent years starting to look beyond the cancer genomics and
okay.
actually look at the microenvironment as well.
Yeah. So there's a lot of complexity to what you're doing here.
Yeah.
And in terms of, like, we know that you know, we each have our kind of individual footprint in terms of the genome, and there's differences between each of our genomes, and that they vary kind of in context between, say, races or, you know, kind of different families within different continents or... and I'm just wondering how race comes into this, and what the context, what you would understand race to be in the context of genomics evolution, because I know in, you know, in some ways, like my understanding would be biologically, it, you know, race is kind of a slightly tricky thing to define now just because of like continental drift and migration patterns and things like that. So I'm just wondering what it is in terms of genomics, what that specific.
So you're right, there is a lot of complexity in terms of race and how that is defined. You know, you can draw out the kind of the you know how people are related. But actually, that tree is actually more complex than it is in cancer. So I was just talking about the evolution in cancer. In cancer, essentially, you have one cell which gives rise to two daughter cells. And those daughter cells will inherit all of the variants, all of the mutations that are in the parent cell. And when you're looking at humans, that actually isn't true. Basically, because each individual has two parents, and you will inherit kind of half of your half of your DNA from your mother and half of your DNA from your father, and so that means that actually it's not so simple to just draw out a tree with the kind of phylogenetic relationship showing the relationship between individuals, and so obviously you'll have people who may have like the all of their DNA that comes from a particular location. So you might have somebody and all of their ancestors have been European. They, they've grown up in Europe and they are, you know, will be quite closely related genetically. But you also, you know, obviously a lot of us are a mixed race, including myself. So I'm about 50% European and 50% Asian. And so obviously that is a challenge in terms of, you know, drawing out the phylogeny. Where do I come from? Because if I actually have DNA which comes from two different branches of the tree, if you're thinking about the tree of all human life. So it's actually much more complicated thinking about the genetic relationship between individuals than it is thinking about the genetic relationship between individual cancer cells. So, yeah, with that caveat, we can look at individuals, we can identify all of the variants within their genome, and typically each individual will have several million, kind of about 3 million or more than that, variants within their genome. Okay. We can look at how many of those variants they share with other individuals. And so we can get a kind of effectively it's kind of distance metric. So we're saying how far away is this individual from another individual. If we do that, then we can see that we have groups of people who have less distance between themselves than they do with people in another group. So we can define genetically groups of people who have broadly similar genetics, and that is because they will have broadly similar ancestry. So they might have, they might share some ancestors. If you go back, you know, some generations, then you will find that those people who have similar genetics likely share some of their ancestors. It is complicated, and it's not as simple as drawing out a tree and saying, well, these people go in this place on the tree, these people go somewhere else. But we can calculate kind of broad metrics that will tell us how similar people are.
Yeah, because I was going to say, I was trying to holistically think about kind of race the other day, and you have, you know, what you would kind of title as social races. And then when it comes to actual kind of biological race, thinking about migration patterns and understanding. So if I was born in France, would that make me French? Or because my parents are English, am I still English?
Yeah.
But it's quite nice that you've got that broader view of saying, okay, well, we can define people in within a category whereby they fit within this group because they are a certain percent related, say.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So I guess because, you know, when we're working within cancer genomics, we will usually kind of look primarily at the genetic kind of definition of race rather than kind of more social definitions of ethnicity.
Yeah.
But that is complicated.
Yeah.
So if we, for example, if we sequenced a set of cancer patients of black cancer patients in Nigeria, say, and then we sequenced a cohort of white patients in the UK, and then we see some differences between those two cohorts, then you know, we would see the genetics, and we can see that there are genetic differences between those two groups, but we don't know if it's the genetic differences that explain the differences in the behaviour of the cancer.
Yeah.
So if you know, if the one set of cancers behaved more aggressively than the other, we wouldn't know if that was because of the genetics or if it was because of environmental effects. So we can't completely ignore those environmental effects or behavioural effects. You know, people might you know, have a different diet, or, you know, might make different life choices which are associated with the aggressiveness of the cancers.
Yeah.
So ideally, what we'd like to do is to study people of different races, but also in different locations.
Yeah.
And then we can hopefully separate out the environmental effects and the genetic effects.
Yeah. So it's kind of like a nature versus nurture. And
absolutely.
Interesting. Yeah. I love it. Yeah, thank you. And I think it's a good thing to remember about, because I hadn't thought about it this way, but the kind of genetic race versus social ethnicity.
Mm.
And it's nice to be able to put them in two discrete categories for this conversation, because otherwise we'll be going around in absolute circles. So you're involved in the International Genomes Consortium.
Yeah.
Very fancy title. Love it. Tell me about it. What does it involve? Yeah. How did you get involved?
Yeah. So the International Cancer Genome Consortium was first started in, I think, around 2008, something like that, 2006. Okay. So it's been around for a while.
Yeah.
And their aim was to collect samples from 25,000 cancers. And this was across all different tumour types, so in different tissues. So they actually, I think, collected samples from, I think, 38 different tumor types, and then they wanted to do DNA sequencing of samples from those cancers. There are different types of sequencing that you can do. So I mostly work with whole genome sequencing, where you sequence every the whole of the DNA, every base within the DNA. But sometimes people just sequence the regions that are actually coding for genes and proteins. Sometimes people just do targeted sequencing of genes that are known to be known to cause cancer. So within that 25,000 set of samples, they didn't have whole genome sequencing from all of the samples. So there was a kind of a subgroup within that set, and that were working with almost 3,000 cancers that had been whole genome sequenced. And they were analysed by a group called the Pan-Cancer Analysis of Whole Genomes. So that's PCAWG. So we call it PCOG, is kind of it's how we normally
science acronyms never end, do they? PCOG.
And I was asked in, I think it was about 2013, if I would lead one of the working groups that was analysing the data within PCOG. So we had these different working groups that were looking at different aspects of cancer genomics.
Okay.
And I was leading one of the working groups that was looking at cancer evolution and heterogeneity, together with Peter Van Loo and Paul Spellman. So there were three of us leading that consortium.
So just quickly, the heterogeneity is the difference between...
So when I'm saying heterogeneity here, I'm talking about heterogeneity within the tumour.
Okay, interesting.
So we have lots of heterogeneity between individuals and between cancers.
And in the tumour.
But here we were looking at the intra-tumour heterogeneity.
Okay.
So the heterogeneity between individual cells within the cancers.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Cool. Sorry to interrupt there. I just needed to clarify slightly.
So we ran that project for it was 5 or 6 years because we had such a large amount of data. That's how long it took to analyze the data. And then we published 2 papers in 2020 and 2021 from those studies in which we reported kind of the evolutionary patterns that we mm-hmm. observed in all of the 38 different tumor types. One thing that was so I think the great strength of that consortium was that it was international and they were working in lots of different countries. One of the I don't want to say deficiencies, but one of the kind of the gaps in that consortium was that it wasn't truly global. So it was international, but actually most of the studies that made up the ICGC were in Europe and North America. There were a smaller number in Asia, but there were actually no projects in Africa.
Yeah.
So it wasn't really truly a global study. So we found out enormous amount of information about cancers in richer countries,
mm-hmm.
But we weren't able to discover very much about how cancer works in those other countries, particularly in Africa.
Yeah, and I guess that's a pattern that's pretty common throughout research history and things. And it's sad, but it's nice to see that this kind of international progression is coming to kind of throughput now, and with Mr. Yeah. Worldwide over here, we're obviously making great steps.
Yeah.
And so just kind of going back to the point of race and this point of Africa, so we kind of see breast cancer, we spoke about it in season one with Gareth Evans, so long ago, we were talking about Gareth earlier, we talked to him about PROCAS, and it was like a looking at the risk assessment. So he was talking about things like BRCA and hereditary genes and things that would increase your risk of developing breast cancer over your lifetime. And it was really interesting to hear that. And within that, I guess, comes the question of kind of different races and different risks. And we know that in, so is it Black African women, the risk of developing breast cancer is more than that in kind of your white Caucasian women.
Yes.
But also the as you've said, the compilation of data that we have available to us is mainly of those Caucasian women. So, I mean, firstly, it's to ask, you know, why is that? Why is that data mainly Caucasian? And secondly, you know, what more do we know about those differences between Black women and Black African women, sorry, and Caucasian women?
Yeah. I think a lot of the reasons are economic.
Yeah.
In the UK, we're very fortunate because the UK government and charities such as CRUK do put a lot of money into cancer research. And yeah, similarly in countries like the US, there is a lot of money going into scientific research. And generally, because the funding is coming from governments or charities within those countries, it's kind of understandable they want to fund projects within their own countries.
Yeah.
And so historically, the majority of funding has been spent within those rich countries who tend to have people who are of European or Asian ancestry.
Yeah.
And there's been, you know, relatively small amounts of funding that have gone into Africa and into South America as well, actually. Why that matters is because if we look at the genetics, I say you can you can, you know, classify people genetically based on the similarity or the difference between their genomes. And so people who are, you know, living in Africa and who are have African ancestry are likely to have a set of variants that are, you know, often similar between individuals. Individuals of African ancestry, mm-hmm. And then if you look at people of European ancestry, you know, similarly, they are likely to share a lot of their mutations, a lot of their variants within their genomes. But when you compare across different races, we see that there's much lower overlap in terms of the variants. So, you know, they have developed these risk prediction tools that will predict how likely, you know, for example, women are to develop breast cancer or to develop aggressive breast cancer. But those have primarily been developed using the genomes from white women in rich mm-hmm. countries, and that, you know, that is the reality.
Yeah.
But that means that they are actually not effective as risk prediction tools, and they're not really able to predict well the probability that a black woman will develop breast cancer.
Yeah, and I guess it's quite limiting as well, not only here, but worldwide. I mean, we've got such a kind of diverse diaspora here, you know, yeah. I don't know the figures at all, but I think because of that, you can understand that there might be, you know, a lack of precision yes. to the treatments yeah. that you can allocate because of that database doesn't hold enough data.
No, that's right. I mean, in the UK, when doctors are doing these trials, they're completely blind. So they'll take all comers, and anybody who is willing to take part in a trial, you know, can do. But because the numbers of people that we have, you know, in the UK, you know, of non-European ancestry will you know obviously be lower yeah. than they are for people of European ancestry.
Yeah.
We just don't have the numbers typically from studies that are carried out just in the UK, and yeah. that's why. So I am now and contributing to a number of collaborations in Africa and also in countries in Asia
yeah.
To collect samples from patients in those countries because we can get data from patients of different ancestries, and also we can look at the environmental effects in those other countries.
Yeah. Okay. So I mean, yeah, we've kind of I understand a lot of the work that you do, and you're in prostate and esophageal, but you're here today to talk about breast. So I mean, reading up about breast cancer, it's quite shocking actually, like the disparities between breast cancer in Caucasian women and breast cancer in Black African women. Mm. And I think, is it kind of that difference is still, you know, if it's Black African women that are in kind of high economically developed countries also have a differentiation in the aggressiveness of Caucasian women in those high economically developed countries. Is that right?
Yes. I mean, that is very interesting observation, actually. Yeah, so,
thank you, David.
So the studies that have been done in Africa, they have shown that there is a higher prevalence, particularly of the more aggressive types of breast cancer in Africa. But when we come to richer countries such as the UK and the US, we've actually removed a lot of the confounders when we do that because
yeah.
we're looking at patients who've grown up in the same country who will be exposed to similar environmental factors, but we still see a significant difference in the prevalence of aggressive breast cancers between Black UK women and white women. White UK women, and a similar observation has been made in the US.
So from that, you can infer that you can remove all environmental impact on that, and that there's some underlying genetics there?
So we think so. Okay. I mean, a bit of care needs to be taken, yeah, because you still have factors such as class. So you know, there are interactions between different social factors.
Oh, yeah, that's a really good point. If you're looking
at race, there will be an interaction with kind of socioeconomic factors.
Yeah.
But it does look like the underlying genetics or ancestry certainly do play a large part in causing that difference in aggressiveness of breast cancer.
And it's a difficult job for you because there are so many cofactors that are contributing to differences in rate. So your modelling must be very blooming complex, to say the least. So can you tell me about the research that you're doing in Nigeria? Just give me a bit of an overview of that.
Yes,
it sounds so interesting.
Yeah.
I've read about it.
So I was contacted, I think, five or six years ago by a researcher, Funmi Olopade. So she works at the University of Chicago, but she carries out most of her research in Nigeria.
Okay.
And she contacted me because she... Well, I think she'd seen some of the work that we'd done previously looking at evolution of cancers, including breast cancer. And she asked me if I wanted to be involved in some of the analysis of the data that she was generating. So she at that time had collected samples from 100 women with breast cancer in Nigeria, and she wanted us to analyse the genomes of those cancers and compare them with a cohort from the US of actually African American women, but also white women in the US. So we took the data, we analysed it through our pipeline. So we have kind of computational pipelines that will run various analyses on the data. And we were looking for kind of signatures that might tell us something about how the tumours might evolve differently, mm-hmm, in the Nigerian women compared to the US women, the black and the white US women. Essentially, that was what we did. We're still actually working with Funmi, and she's now built up her cohort to several hundred women, and we're continuing to analyse those samples.
So just to clarify, they were all black African.
That's right, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah, because obviously it's quite interesting. You've got the distinguished, like, yeah, kind of black American, black Afro-Caribbean. There's a lot of different sets of data that I can understand that you'd have to collect. And what were the confounding differences that you saw in terms of the kind of aggressiveness of the cancer, and what was different about the cancer that these kind of black African women that were presenting with than that you'd seen previously in white Caucasian women?
Yeah, so I mean, we were primarily focused on the genomics.
Yeah.
And when I say that, we weren't looking at the inherited genetics. So we know obviously that the black women have different ancestry, and they will have a different inherited genome that they will have inherited from their parents. We actually weren't looking at that. What we were looking at was what we call the somatic mutations. So these would be the mutations that have occurred within a patient's body during their lifetime.
Yeah.
So in cancer, we can see all of these mutations. So typically, a breast cancer would have around 5,000 mutations. Some cancers have more and some have less, but around 5,000 mutations that have occurred just within the cancer cells. And we can also see the kind of large scale rearrangements that I was talking about earlier. So we were looking at the somatic mutational pattern within the Nigerian women, African American women, and the white women in the US. What we found that was surprising was that we saw a high rate of mutation in this gene called GATA3, and GATA3 has previously been seen in breast cancer in white women in the UK. Mm. But what was surprising in Nigeria was first that we saw it had a much higher prevalence in that group than we've seen in other cohorts, for example, in the UK and the US. But also we saw that the GATA3 mutations were occurring across all the different subtypes. Okay. So within breast cancer, there's been a lot of work done that's identified that not all breast cancers are the same, that we can separate them into different subtypes. And they're often called hormonal subtypes because we'll look at for example, we'll look at estrogen receptor and see the expression mm-hmm. of that that receptor. So we can separate breast cancers into ER positive and ER negative tumors.
So that's estrogen receptor.
That's
positive.
Right, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And we also look at some other genes such as HER2. So we can have HER2 positive and HER2 negative tumors. So previously GATA3 has been reported to primarily occur in, I think, HER2 negative tumors.
Okay.
But when we looked in Nigeria, yeah. we saw actually very similar prevalence of GATA3 mutations in the HER2 positive and the HER2 negative tumors. So it looks like something very different is going on in terms of the genetics, the somatic genetics of breast cancer in Nigerian women versus US women.
Okay, and it's interesting to break it down. So you have your germline, which is your inherited, and then your somatic, which is your what changes after you are kind of a fetus, basically.
Yes, embryo. Exactly. And I mean, I suppose because I tend to think about things through an evolutionary perspective, that it probably isn't surprising if there's actually an interaction between the germline, the inherited genetics, and your somatic genomics.
Yeah.
Because those mutations are occurring kind of on the background of the inherited genome. So all of your cells have your inherited variation, your germline variation. And then when a mutation comes along in the cancer, that's occurring on top of the pre-existing mutations.
Yeah.
So actually we're not really surprised if there's a link, an interaction between the germline genetics and the somatic genomics.
Yeah. God, it's all very complex. So just to simplify it for our listeners slightly, what you're saying is that between, when you were looking at the cohorts holistically, between the white Caucasian and the black African women, what you saw in their genome, and you were studying the somatic kind of cell line, which is what you develop after you have been conceived, so it's not inherited, is that you saw kind of a higher prevalence of some of the tumor driver genes. Is that the way that you'd define them?
Yes, we would, yeah.
Okay, and was there less genomic stability? Was there more genomic instability within that cohort, that
Black
African?
So we did see that.
Okay.
So there was another key driver gene. So we had GATA3. We also had quite a lot of our tumours that had mutations in TP53, which is a very well-known driver gene, which causes a lot of genomic instability. If we separated the tumours into those that had GATA3 mutations and those that had TP53 mutations, then we saw more genomic instability in the tumours that had TP53 mutations.
Okay.
But actually, when we looked at the cohort as a whole, they generally had more genomic instability than the breast cancers in white US women.
Okay. And what does genomic instability mean at the kind of the level of the genome?
Yes. So genomic instability is to do with how the cancer DNA is different from your normal healthy DNA. So when we look at the DNA, we're looking at the mutations that are occurring in the cancer, but we always actually look at the blood. We'll look at a blood sample as well. So when we collect a sample from a patient's tumor, we will also take a blood sample and we'll look at the DNA in the blood, and then we'll look at the DNA in the tumor, and we'll see what's different.
Mm-hmm.
And what we see is that we have you're lots of these small mutations, single nucleotide variants. We've got this one base pair in the genome that's changed, but we also have lots of these large-scale rearrangements. Yeah. So when we talk about genomic instability, what we're mainly talking about is those large-scale rearrangements. So not just the single point mutations, but these massive rearrangements. And they can affect a large part of the genome. So just having one rearrangement could affect lots of different genes.
Okay.
So those can have a much stronger effect on the cells than just having a single point mutation.
So can that increase the aggressiveness of the tumour then?
Yes, it okay. can, yeah. So it can increase the aggressiveness of the tumour because having these rearrangements can affect lots of different genes. And if you have a lot of genomic instability, it means that you are the cells are requiring lots of changes to their genome at every cell division. So every time a cell divides and gives rise to two daughter cells, you'll have more and more genomic instability. So they evolve much faster. And you're also just generating, because you're generating lots of heterogeneity, that kind of gives the raw material that evolution can act on. So if you've got lots of different cells that all have different mutations, then some of them may not benefit the tumour at all. Mm-hmm. And actually some of those cells might die because they're not benefited at all by the genomic instability. But then if you happen to get one cell that has acquired the functionality to actually make it more competitive, maybe to divide faster or to be less likely to die, then that will continue to grow faster. Mm-hmm. It'll give rise to more daughter cells.
Yeah.
And that's why we get evolution and we get cancers kind of progressively become more and more aggressive as they grow.
Interesting. So basically what we've kind of surmised is that we can't negate the interaction of environmental factors, socioeconomic factors, sort of things like diet. But what we have here from this study is a grounding in the fact that the interplay of the kind of the genome and these different genetics and expressions of different genes is contributing to the fact that Black African women present with breast cancer earlier and at a later stage that is more aggressive.
Yes, okay. we think so. We think that there is a genetic contribution to that aggressiveness.
Yeah. Got it. So interesting. And I'll link the paper for everybody because I've had obviously a bit of a read of it as is required. But it's really interesting, the research that you've gone into. And I guess my next question would be like, what are the next stages of that? You've done this kind of, what was it, two initial studies that you've done? One in 2018, was the first one that you were involved in this one, and then there was one before? Am I getting that wrong?
So there were some previous studies from that cohort that were published before I joined that.
You didn't
group.
Have your hands on that.
No. So I only have my name on one paper at the moment. But we are still working with that cohort, and it keeps getting larger and larger. And we are we're continuing to do the whole genome sequencing to look at the DNA. We're also now expanding the analysis, so we're doing other things. So we're looking at the RNA and the proteins within the tumors. We're also now doing multiple sampling. So in some cases, we're able to get quite large samples from the tumors, and particularly if the women have undergone surgery to remove the cancer, then we can actually get a really large chunk of the tumor, and then we can take small biopsies from that tumor, and then we can actually sequence lots of different regions of the tumor.
Okay.
So that gives us a lot more information about the heterogeneity and the evolution that's occurring within those tumors. So we're kind of going further and getting more resolution in terms of looking at the heterogeneity and the evolution in the tumors.
Interesting. And I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if people were listening and thinking, well, it's all blooming very well and good that we know about these differences between two cohorts in terms of genetics. But what is the application of that in a clinical setting and kind of a medicinal, medical setting?
So, I mean, I think the starting point for me is that we do need to generate more knowledge. Because until very recently, there were no whole genome studies in Africa. So I think this paper that we're talking about was actually the first paper to report whole genome sequencing of any cohort of cancer patients in Africa. And so I think the first step is just to generate that knowledge. We need to know how cancers work, how they evolve in African women, well, in black women in Africa and in other countries. I think that now we are starting to get that knowledge, and we can kind of see there are some kind of insights into how we might be able to treat those patients with kind of different, slightly different ways to how we might treat white women in the UK. I guess one of the hints is around the genomic instability that we've talked about. So there are treatments that are particularly effective on tumours that are genomically unstable. So there are things that we call PARP inhibitors. That's a drug that can be given that is particularly effective on tumours that have this genomic instability. I think radiotherapy tends to be somewhat more effective on tumours that are genomically unstable. So, you know, there are treatments that we know of that may be more effective on these particular types of tumours, but we haven't really yet explored, or it hasn't really been explored in particularly in Africa. So I think those would be the next steps, would be to see if we can kind of tune treatments more towards individual people's cancers. And one of the factors that I think we could be taking into account when we're looking at individuals is their ancestral background, their race.
Amazing. So that's what you're talking about there, is precision medicine as a whole then, and understanding that if you can kind of get somebody down to understanding what their genome is, then you would hope that in the future precision medicines can be applied that would kind of precisely and personalized medicine within that.
Exactly. And I think you know, race is just one of the factors that could be taken into account. I mean, ultimately we're not aiming just to tailor treatment towards one particular group of people, but we are really aiming for personalized treatment. I think that this is just one aspect of that
journey. Striving towards that health equity then.
Absolutely.
It's interesting because I guess as well, the way that medicines have been devised within, say, the UK would have been based on a Caucasian background.
Yes.
And Caucasian clinical trials. So then you can kind of see there how people slip through the hoops, because the treatment that is applied as a kind of a blanket within the UK that is based on those data sets won't then apply to these other cohorts. So it's so interesting to kind of think about the minutiae of it, and then where your work is going to feed in and hopefully be implemented in healthcare systems as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it is a question of equity and of inclusion.
Yeah.
And we are also doing other studies in other countries. So we're looking at prostate cancer in South Africa, looking at esophageal cancer in Kenya.
Yeah.
And we also have some studies looking at breast cancer in Asia. So we've got a paper that we're about to submit to the journals on breast cancer in Hong Kong, and we're also just started work with collaborators in Malaysia, looking at breast cancer and ovarian cancer in Malaysia. I mean, we're really trying to broaden out to as many different regions and as many different ethnicities as we can.
God, that's absolutely incredible! I didn't know all that. You really are Mr. Worldwide, you and the team. That's great to hear. And I think, it's really humbling to know about these projects that are going on outside of Europe and this kind of Eurocentric sphere that we sometimes end up living in. Just coming kind of roundhouse. Is that the word? Or does that mean something else? Is that a baseball term? I don't know, we'll go with it, won't we? Roundhouse. What are your hopes for the future of genomics research as a whole?
Yeah, so, I mean, I think in terms of the global genomics, we're certainly going in the right direction. You know, I've talked a bit about my research, but it's, I think, you know, lots of people now are doing research, much broader research covering people of different races and of different social classes as well. I think that's another important differentiator. We're also moving beyond the genome and starting to look much more at the interaction between the cancer cells and the tumor microenvironment. Mm-hmm. And there are lots of new techniques that are coming out now that allow you to look much more at the kind of spatial distribution. So most of what we've done until recently has been taking a piece of tissue, kind of chopping it all up and then sequencing it. But there are now a lot of novel techniques that can carry out sequencing without kind of chopping up all the tissue. So you can actually see the kind of spatial arrangements. You can see how individual tumor cells are interacting with other tumor cells and with their environment. And so we're doing a lot of work now in that space, and so moving beyond the genomics and looking at the more of the interaction between the tumor cells and the environment. So I think that those are the areas that I think, you know, I'm working on. I think a lot of other people are very interested in as well.
Interesting. And at the start of the podcast, you talked about your slightly transitory career jumps. Do you feel fulfilled in what you're doing now?
So I don't plan on moving anywhere else. I think I'm going to be staying with cancer genomics or omics. So we're now looking at proteomics and transcriptomics as well as the genomics.
Crikey.
But no, I don't think I'm going to be going anywhere else now.
That's what I was trying to ask, but in a really polite PC way. It's basically, David, don't go anywhere. Well, thank you so much. So you've kind of talked to us about what we understand as race within genomics, the difference between genomics and genetics, the importance of internationalization, your research projects and breast cancer. And I know you've mentioned a few others in, we've got breast cancer in Hong Kong, and then you've mentioned kind of prostate and esophageal, and I'd love to grab you and talk to you about them all at some point. We unfortunately don't have enough time to go through your portfolio. And then, yeah, we've talked about your hopes for the future, and it's been great. Absolutely lovely discussion with you. So honestly, thank you so much for taking your time away from, you know, computer software. Really appreciate it. You definitely need a break from there once in a while. And yeah, thank you ever so much for just sitting and talking with me and letting our audience hear about everything that you do.
Thank you.
Been great. And guys, I'll link all of the stuff because there's kind of a few papers that you might be interested in, and I'm sure, David, we can link
of course, the software and everything. Yes.
But yeah, thank you guys for listening to our very special episode with Mr. Worldwide. And yeah, we'll speak to you next time. If you have been affected by anything you've heard in this episode, please see the show notes for a list of charities and organisations that can help.
1 in 2 was brought to you by the University of Manchester and the Manchester Cancer Research Centre. Listen to our next episode to hear from more of our researchers as they share the innovations, discoveries and projects that are changing the landscape of cancer prevention, early detection and treatment. To find out more about what you've heard today, please see the show notes for this episode, where you'll find a transcript and links to further information and research. Cancer is one of the university's 5 research beacons, showcasing the interdisciplinary collaborations and cross-sector partnerships that are tackling some of the biggest questions facing the planet. To hear more about Manchester's research in advanced materials, biotechnology, cancer, energy, and global inequalities, go to manchester.ac.uk/beacons.